Okay, and welcome back. It's Friday night, and we tell her again tonight. Cosmic Ray has been the man who has really put Venus on the map in terms of a location to look at, a destination where things apparently are being hidden and sequestered from us. Lots of indications that Venus is not the inhospitable hellhole that we are taught all the time, just like Mars apparently now has enough oxygen in the atmosphere that somebody could survive, they say, without oxygen supplementation, which is very interesting, to put it mildly. There, are you there, Ray?
Yes, I'm here, Jeff. Thank you.
How's Venus?
Oh, it's a cool, calm, and collected.
I hope you get to go there sometime. You deserve it. Wouldn't that be fun? Are you going to tell me you've already been there?
Oh, yes, I've been there, and it's a great, great place.
You have gone there.
Now you just
stepped in it. All right. You're not going to get away. You're not going to get away without telling us that story. So what happened?
Well, in my third book, I explain about it's a very long story, but it's Earth-like in many respects, and I had a most excellent adventure there. That was what my entire third book was about.
Oh, very good. Okay, we talked to Craig Campobasso last hour about his work on trying to bring the Valiant Thor story to the major motion picture venue. Are there any other that you've heard about Venusians who are here or who have been here since Valiant Thor was or remains? He may still be here. What else is going on between Earth and Venus? I guess that's the question.
There's always been a large contingent of Venusians on the Earth, insofar as Venus is our sister planet, and throughout the ages, various teachers have enlightened us about their presence. Tannhauser, Rumi, Dante, Emanuel Swedenborg, and others. But since the advent of the atomic and space ages in the mid to late 1940s forward, the Venusian presence here on Earth has intensified immensely.
What are they like about us? We're really going in the wrong direction in many ways. What are they hoping to somehow turn us around and course correct our descent into madness? What are they looking for?
Yes, they're respecting our sovereignty, but trying to nudge our culture, our societies in a direction that is less self-destructive and less a danger to them and other planets in the solar system. Everything is interconnected, and there are lines of magnetic reconnection to all the planets in the solar system.
Uh-huh.
So anything we do on this planet will have an exponential effect on other planets in the system.
Well, that's what I've heard for a long time. And certainly when you take into account what we've seen and learned about Mars and how we've been conned and lied to, about the color of the Martian ground, the sand, the rocks, the sky. We've been lied to so much. It really is, it's quite insulting. We're finding things out all the time about Mars, and just imagine what we might be able to find out about Venus.
Oh,
now,
yes,
through
and
your,
all the,
your
all...
books have helped a lot, of course, but I'd like to see a rover on Venus like we have Curiosity on Mars, although they say it's too hot, but I don't believe it.
And, well, there's so much that's being revealed, not only about Venus, but all the planets of the solar system. And many of the contactees not just myself, but many others throughout the recent decades have been telling us about life on other planets in our solar system, including on the far side of our own moon, where there's an observation, extraterrestrial observation post, and other bases there.
All right, very good. Okay, we have a number of things posted under Ray's name and guests. If you want to go to Rents.com, take a look. You'll certainly see. There's something we can start with, and it has to do with Mormonism. That's the first piece up there. I'm not sure if that's the order you wanted to go in, but that's what they're up there. It's Mormonism and E.T. gods. Now, this is an interesting piece. You wrote this piece.
Yes, I wrote this. I wrote this in a seminary class at the Graceland University in Independence, Missouri.
Wow, that's Harry Truman's country.
Yes, in the theology class, and I wanted to take a look at any possible extraterrestrial connections with the community of Christ, which includes the entire restoration movement or Latter-day Saints, Latter-day Saintism.
Ray, how old were you when you wrote this?
I wrote this just recently, this year.
Okay, so you've got a lot of perspective you've woven into this. That makes sense now. I get it. I was thinking as a young man, that's a pretty heady area to get involved with.
Oh, yes.
If you had been in your 20s or
something. Younger years, I wasn't thinking too much about it. But but one of the things that that I emphasize in my Venus books and my research and going on the road is that people look into their religious beliefs and that they don't... you know, they don't give up on their religion. I'm not asking anybody to change their religion or join any group or cult or anything, but just to live up to the highest precepts of their own religion. And extraterrestrial is a word that includes everything beyond the earth. So, of course, that would include angels and other celestial beings that sometimes we may interpret as aliens or extraterrestrials.
Well, we do know that Christianity and the Bible are loaded with references to things that could easily be descriptions of off-planet, on-planet intelligence. Many. There have been books written about all the allusions in there to extraterrestrial visitation. Many, I guess, of the world's great religions have similar allusions to potential off-planet visitors, correct?
Oh, yes. This is quite true. The Bhagavad Gita, the Quran, all have references to various supernatural beings. Now, the great science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke once said that any technology of the extraterrestrials being so in advance of ours would appear unto us as something akin to magic.
Magic, sure, yeah.
And so we see a lot of interpretations, a lot of religions, but they may all be reflecting this extraterrestrial presence here on Earth in past ages, and that's why I felt that it was important to write this article from my own religious perspective.
Well, Joseph Smith, you mentioned here, did Joseph Smith have an ET connection of some kind that was known at the time?
I believe that he did because
I remember somebody telling me something about that a long time ago, and I can't remember what it was. But there was some kind of a something in his life was definitely of the paranormal, not just the tablets, but the other parts of it.
Oh, Yes, in the community that he grew up in upstate New York, there was a huge fascination with magic and the occult, looking at peepstones and encounters with angels and so forth. And throughout Joseph Smith's life, he had encountered some 48 beings of an ethereal nature.
Not necessarily, and angels either. Just
not necessarily.
Right.
Not necessarily. And when it comes to theology, of course, there's so many interpretations and so many debates in this area, because it's so subjective. It's such a subjective phenomenon. So it's like arguing, the futility of it is like arguing over how many angels can stand on the head of a pin. It's clear to me that there's some force beyond the earth, or forces that are impinging upon our reality. Mm-hmm. And religion is one perspective of looking at it and providing an interpretation.
Was Joseph Smith a contactee? There's talk about that.
Yes, I would say that he was one of the first American contactees, although the psychologist James, I forget his first name, he was from Scotland and came to the United States. And I think it was like 1901, he wrote a book on religious experiences, the variety of religious experiences, mm-hmm. and details many encounters with supernatural beings, deities, angels, and so forth. And as I read through the whole book from cover to cover, it's like some 500 pages, but I was really impressed of the similarity between the varieties of religious experience and UFO close encounters of the third kind.
Right. Well, there's no question that Joseph Smith also had a very unusual hairstyle.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, I would say so. I provided a photograph of him on that article.
Well, that's Venusian. That's the Venusian pompadour.
So he was born in 1805 in Vermont, and of course he was assassinated, unfortunately, in 1844 in Carthage jail.
Yeah, he was only, 39, something like that?
Yes, Yeah, 39.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, what else do you have for us tonight, Ray, that we've got posted up there?
Okay, I have some articles here by myself about Dr. James E. McDonald and the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
What an important figure he is, and doesn't get nearly enough attention.
Yeah. Oh, yes, and in an age... when the Condon Report was coming into full bloom and taking all the attention, taking all the wind out of the sails of the extraterrestrial hypothesis in the scientific community, James McDonald was standing forth to clearly explain and advocate that position to the American people and the world. So I really appreciated that, and I felt that his life was largely misunderstood, and even to this day. He was also a subscriber to the publication that I was putting out in the 1960s called The Flying Saucer Report.
James McDonald was. Well, good for you.
Yes.
That's quite a compliment.
He even sent an article there that we published in, I think it was in 1968.
All right, tell us more about James McDonald. I'm listening to the program for the first time. I know nothing about him. I do, but pretend like I don't. Tell us more about this man and why he is important.
Well, he was a physicist at the University of Arizona, dealing with weather and space phenomena. And a lot of the things that he speculated upon about travel in space and types of spacecraft and so forth were later proven to be, you know, theoretically possible. It struck me that in watching the latest version of Star Wars about the space beacons, for example.
Yes,
he was writing about this stuff, fixed position beacons, a lighthouse network of these objects in space between different star sectors, between different solar systems that would feed information that allowed visiting spacecraft or spacecraft
to navigate
in the vicinity.
Yeah.
Yes, to make hyperspace jumps and to navigate safely between star sectors in the galaxy.
I want to just read a little of this, written by Ray. He writes, "Many of the prominent space scientists of the 1960s were leaning strongly in favor of the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Dr. James E. McDonald, 1920 to 1971, was one of those. Dr. McDonald suggested that some UFOs might be best explained as actual physical spacecraft occupied by advanced ET life or non-human aliens from other planets visiting our world, despite being remotely tucked away, as it is on the rim of the Milky Way galaxy." We're way out here. Dr. McDonald was a noted American physicist and tenured prof at the Department of Meteorology, University of Arizona, Tucson. All right, but he was best known for his UFO research. In an interview with Major H.C. Peterson, co-editor of Denmark's UFO Contact, published in June 1968, Dr. McDonald commented, quote, "It is remotely possible that newly detected mysterious signals from outer space may be galactic navigational beacons, as you just heard Ray say, being employed by an advanced civilization to guide their manned ships along the Milky Way." When asked to elaborate on these signals, Dr. McDonald remarked that while radio astronomers making the observations are reluctant to speculate publicly on artificial origins, they are talking privately about the possibility that these sources are navigation beacons or segments of a communications net linking a number of highly advanced civilizations. He was a very advanced, open-minded, a very creative thinker, Dr. McDonald.
Oh, yes, and this was taking place in the mid-1960s.
Yeah.
And he was talking to one of Europe's leading contactee journals that focused on the experiences of George Adamski, and, of course, other scientists poo-pooed the idea totally that Adamski or anybody else could be in contact with Venusians, but Dr. McDonald was open-minded enough to consider the possibilities.
Okay, what happened to Dr. McDonald?
Well, he was found dead apparently committing a suicide.
Apparently,
in 1971, his body was found under a gully wash under a bridge in Tucson, Arizona.
Suspicious death, wasn't it?
Oh yes, and this was a big concern to Otto Binder, and he had written an article published in Saga magazine in 1971, possibly inspired by this case, about all of the mysterious deaths of ufologists and scientific investigators of UFO phenomena.
Right, right. Well, Dr. McDonald was only 51, and I've done programs where people who knew him were on years ago. They say that he didn't commit suicide. Just leave it at that. They don't believe it. He was getting too close to some very sensitive material.
Yes, and in this series of articles, especially part three, which I believe it's being posted up there. I don't know if
we didn't get it. We didn't get it in time for tonight. We'll get it up there later, though. It'll go.
Oh, okay.
We got parts one and two up there.
Oh, that would be awesome, because part three talks about his experience with the Silence Group, and right before his death, he had a briefcase stolen.
Yes,
with all his slides and his UFO reports and investigations, and connecting with various phenomena and the extraterrestrial hypothesis. But one thing that was of particular note was that he was investigating at the time of his death some encounters out at the naval weapons station out at China Lake.
Yes,
in the eastern, which was already part of California,
was already tabbed as an above top secret location, and they didn't like him messing around out there.
Yes, and then, as you said, he was just getting a little bit too close to the truth, I believe.
Right. Very interesting man. Anything else we want to mention about this fellow? Dr. James E. McDonald?
Yes. One of his missions was to advocate the serious and scientific investigation of UFOs among among academia, the scientific establishment. And he traveled to many university campuses and research centers. And one of the most significant speeches that he gave was on the 26th of January, 1968, to United Aircraft Research Laboratories in East Hartford, Connecticut. And he argued for expanding technology and a further fundamental scientific research, real scientific research into the UFO phenomena. He didn't have much trust in the Condon report. Dr. Edward U. Condon,
right,
at the University of Colorado, because he believed that that they were seriously skipping over.
Oh, it was a cover up.
Significant cases on purpose.
Of course.
So they would. So even though. Even though they did that, they still couldn't explain about 10% of the UFO cases, and those are the ones that later on Dr. McDonald wanted to pick apart piece by piece, to totally deconstruct those and show that that there really is a possibility there of an extraterrestrial connection.
Sure. He was really at just the beginning of the peak of his adult life and his research. He was just getting into it big time. That's the way I look at it anyway.
He did say, here's a quote that's significant. He said, "Throughout the entire world, only a small handful of scientists have even taken the trouble to attempt direct checks on the puzzling and recurring reports of UFO phenomena.
That's right.
Compared with that handful, there has been a large and rather vocal group who have either explicitly or indirectly ridiculed the notion that there might be unconventional craft-like objects operating over our planet. And their scoffing has been based not upon extensive personal investigations of UFO reports, of which he had personally investigated about 500, but primarily upon a priori considerations."
Right.
And so he was saying that some of those he listed about seven or eight of them, natural phenomena, misinterpretations of astronomical phenomena, misidentification of conventional aircraft, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So they had these preconceived notions of what UFO reports should be cataloged as, and he wanted them, he didn't necessarily want them to come out and admit the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but just to look at these reports objectively. And
he was a real academic.
The scientific.
A real scientist.
Yes, and in every way.
Yeah. All right. Hold on just a minute. We have to pick up a little bit of a break here at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back with Dr. Ray Keller after this. Okay, I've got part three. We'll put part three up there tomorrow. It'll be connected, so it'll be part of the information that we have logged in permanently. But the disappearing UFO experiencers, that's another piece that we can get into if you want. That's the part three I'm talking about. We're not talking about Dr. McDonald, or is that the same thing?
Oh yes, there's a part three to the Dr. McDonald story, and a part.
I didn't get those.
And there's also a part three to the disappearing UFO.
So what's next, Ray? What do you want to go to next?
Okay. Yes, we could talk about the disappearing UFO experiencers.
Okay. It's another article that Ray wrote himself, and go ahead.
Okay. Well, in this case, what inspired me to write this was the experience I had up on Mount Shasta with a woman who did disappear and had returned to Earth from the celestial realms. And back in 1987, I went up there with a group of eight people. We were following Reverend Clayton Parker up there from Murray, Utah, where we had our UFO meetings. And he said that that if we went up there to Mount Shasta, this was after a little ways after the harmonic convergence that took place.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that we would meet an ascended master. And so we said, yeah, sure. He's 87 years old. So we thought we'd, go up there and, knows?
Might as well.
Maybe something would happen, and besides, it would be nice, a nice place to go hang out, do some camping, and so forth. So we went up there, and a lot of synchronicitous events happened along the way, we started to think, well, maybe something will happen up there. But we got to the parking area. And he said that we'd have to go...
Daytime or nighttime, Ray?
Daytime.
Uh-huh.
That we would have to go there ourselves the rest of the way. And he said, just follow the trail. And so we did, and we got above the tree line. to this area where there was an abundance of boulders and a spring coming out of the rock, and we were getting tired, so we sat down, and then this woman just materialized in a flash of light. She had a white jumpsuit with some gold braid on.
Huh.
And she said she knew who we were. And
how many were in your group again?
There were eight.
Okay. Well, what are you thinking when this woman appears, right?
I was in awe, and I definitely believed everything that Clayton had ever told us.
Mm-hmm. Did you try to give her your phone number or anything?
Well, she said she was there to answer our questions about flying saucers, and
now if you excuse me, you're going to be at Mount Shasta next weekend, I believe.
Yes, I will. As a matter of fact, I'll be up there with a whole group of persons who are intimately associated with everything the planet Venus.
Are you going to go back to the location where this woman appeared to you in 1987?
Yes, I'll be going back there, and
you can find it.
Oh yes, I'll be able to find this location, and Rob Potter, who's sponsoring the conference, he knows where the area is.
I mean, you can find. Well. Is there a sign there? Woman appeared here in 1987 to Dr. Ray Keller.
No signs like that. No signs there. But this event has been written up before. It was in the when I got home to New Mexico. Mm-hmm. It was written up in the paper because I talked about it at a UFO club, and. It's been written up in some book about Close Encounters, as well as in my own, in the first Venus book, Venus Rising, A Concise History of the Second Planet. But she explained that, she said her name was Lady Ankara, and that she came from, she was standing in a interdimensional gate that connected, the Earth with a planet called Baylaton in the Sirius star sector, mm-hmm. and that it was her planet was about three times the size of the Earth, and it was mostly land instead of water. It had a mountainous terrain similar to Northern California, with more fresh water than the Earth. And she said that they lived in a communal existence. They lived in these large log, like long houses, mm-hmm. In very close association with nature. And that long ago they had left the technology behind because it was becoming their master, so they had to fight a war against
we're talking
AI,
about
our
yeah, I was going to say AI. Uh-huh.
She said that there were many colonies there from other worlds in a galactic federation of light, that there's 51 member planets, and that her regular home was on Venus, and that they had a Venusian colony there, and this was the home of these large mantids creatures. They were like 5 to 15 feet long, and they could be seen. She said if we looked up the side of the mountain, we could see these creatures, because
on the side of Mount Shasta?
Yes, on the side of Mount Shasta, because she said, as long as we were standing in this vortex or this portal, that we were bilocated on both the worlds because of a bifurcation in time and space.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw them with our, I guess, with spiritual eyes, you could say. And she said that these beings guarded the stargates. And that the women ruled the society because they had the ability to communicate telepathically with the with these manted creatures. But she answered all of our questions, and then for about 3 hours, and then when she bid us. Was going to bid us farewell. Kay Studstrup, who was in our group, asked if she could take a picture of Lady Inkara, and so she agreed to it. And she was standing in the middle of the group, and at that point, a picture was snapped. And when we got back to Utah, to Reverend Clayton's house. There was no. We took it to a 1 hour photo mat, and we were all in the group was all there, but that went up there, and then but she wasn't anywhere in the picture. We were all huddled around.
Was the space that she occupied in the group in the picture, or was she just not there at all? No space.
She wasn't there at all. It's like she wasn't there.
Hmm. You know what I'm saying is like that. You look and there's four people across. One, two. She was number three. Then number four. Was this number three space just empty, or was there no number three space there?
There was like no number three space there. It was just like she was invisible. Like maybe the light was just going right through her. She was transparent, but. When we got back down and we explained everything to Reverend Parker, then he explained to us that he explained his relationship with a woman named Annalise Guerin, and he was born just a year later than this Miss Annalise. She was born on the seventh hour of the seventh day of the seventh month in 1899 in a town called American Falls, Idaho. And she had gone on to write nine books about spiritual and metaphysical phenomena and how you can get into heaven through the back door, what she described as a process of translation.
Hi. No, wait a minute. Get into heaven through the back door. Translation.
In other words, that you don't have to physically die, that you can just be lifted up bodily like Elijah.
Huh.
Or
do you get to come back, or is that it? One-way ticket?
No, you can come and go.
Is this lucid dreaming? OBE?
No. This is in physical time, in physical reality.
Well, that's quite a back door.
Oh, yes. And she said that this is how the angels move back and forth across time and space.
They use the back door.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all right.
And so I've got all of her books and read them from
cover to cover. And so what do you think about after reading all of her books?
Oh, I definitely believe it, and I've researched her life, and that's what I write about in Venus Rising in the last chapter.
Uh-huh.
It's called, the last chapter is Gods of Aquarius, and so I write about her and other persons who have been bodily translated to other worlds.
Well, the article is called The Disappearing UFO Experiencers. In the article, are you listing people who have just vanished and then come back, or just vanished and not come back? You know, a lot of people disappear from our national parks every year, and they're never seen again. There have been several books written about this. I think it's called 444 or something like that is in the title. I had the author on several times. Very interesting. When you go into a national park, there's a lot going on there that apparently people aren't told about. I know that may sound silly, but the books have it. And this guy is a former police detective who wrote it.
Very oh, yes, I definitely believe that. Well, about 90,000 people are reported missing in the United States every year. And sure. I began to be fascinated by this, so I looked at FBI reports and so forth, and then also from other countries like Australia and China. And this is a universal phenomena. So I began to look at the demographics of missing people and mm-hmm. and some of the reasons, you know, their ethnicities and so forth, and their backgrounds, and it's definitely a universal phenomena, and it's not just in national parks, but a lot of times in just plain sight, people just blink out. And of course, you know, in Australia, they say that they have this thing called walkabout, where people just go out for a pack of cigarettes and never come back.
Right.
You know, but there's a lot of course, there's a lot of reasons why people would disappear. So you have to look at the most obvious ones first. They might have been in the woods without you know, their prescribed medicine or life-saving medication. They could have been lost, you know, lost in the woods. There could have been foul play involved. They could want to purposely disappear for one reason or another, maybe to escape a bad situation or something. But there is a definite a percentage of these, a goodly percentage, that are associated with mysterious fires and lights apparitions and so forth. So it and UFO sightings. So it leads me to believe that there's a definite connection besides the ones that I write about in my book that I know from personally meeting.
Yeah, the book's called Missing 411. There's several books now. Very interesting books. Missing 411. Missing people in America's national parks. True stories. They're gone.
And this is also a common theme in religions too, of translated beings, or I think in the New Age community they say that they're ascended beings or ascended individuals. So you know, we mentioned Enoch before, but
right.
John the Beloved never died, and there's in the Book of Mormon there's these three Nephites that never died either. They were just taken up into heaven, and they appear to people in all kinds of situations and places throughout the millennia.
Yeah, I see. I'm looking up the author, David Politis. He's written five books now. Missing 411.
Wow.
Missing 411. Yeah, they're available on Amazon. Let me see here. Hold on.
Then I was looking at other, you know, other religions, like in the Roman, during the Roman times.
Uh-huh.
And we see that Virgil and Ovid and other Roman historians had written about the appearance of divine or celestial beings that trod the earth as real men and women, and they would just come and go. They may have started off as normal human beings, but their heroic deeds or acts of valor won them a place in the celestial realms.
There's excellent reviews on 90% 5-star on these books. Taken at face value as just so stories, the incidents in this book are bone-chilling. Politis presents the facts, and almost unprecedented in books dealing with the unknown, wisely refrains from presenting an explanation or a general conclusion. The nation's forests are wild and beautiful, but also deadly. The book eliminates normal disappearances and concentrates on the unknown to devastating emotional and cognitive effect. We want to know, we need to know what is happening, but we are not allowed to know. Not because Politis knows and won't tell us, but because the cases themselves are so utterly unresponsive to standard investigative methodology. Be afraid, be very afraid, is a pragmatic caveat for reading this book and its companion volume. So, seriously, if you're going off into the national forests, common sense tells you, always go in a group of at least three. Don't go by yourself. And even so, people will walk around a tree and the other two right behind them, and the person's gone. I'll never forget having him on the program. Just incredible stories, one after another.
Wow.
After another. So if you're out this summer in the national parks, do not let your children get more than 3-4 feet away from you. Seriously. And if you don't believe me, just pick up one of these books and read it. It's called Missing 411, 411.
Oh, yes, and that would just make common sense, too, you know, apart from the missing persons, but, I mean, bears and, you know, other wild animals.
Exactly,
and,
exactly.
And then children wandering by themselves if they fall in a ravine or a river, you know, it's
they've found some of the circumstances of the disappeared will make your hair stand up. They're really scary. Normal. Something else going on. I don't know what.
Oh yes. Well, one of the individuals that we look at in this article is Granger Taylor from up in British Columbia in Canada, mm-hmm. His is a very interesting story. He disappeared in 1980 when he was 32 years old, and people said he was some kind of a genius. He was really fascinated with inventions.
What was his name
again? Granger Taylor.
Okay.
He was known as a celestial mechanic because he built a replica of a flying saucer in his backyard. He built a lot of other kind of gizmos.
Mm-hmm.
On his property, but one day in 1980 he just disappeared, and his closest friend interestingly had shared my last name, Keller, and he mm-hmm. told the story about Keller. He said that he was a little bit reclusive and a bit antisocial, mm-hmm. and dropped out of high school.
Kind of like 40. You, Ray. Just like you.
Yeah, a lot like me.
Right.
a little bit on the nerdy side.
Hey, listen.
However, when truant officers came out to his home to discover mm-hmm. what might be the problem with young Granger, they found him putting on the final touches to a revolutionary one-cylinder car that he had constructed in his parents' garage.
Huh. But
his most famous invention was the UFO-like shelter that he assembled in the backyard. And he always spent his time in lounging around in his flying saucer, thinking about extraterrestrials and the most likely date for their arrival on Earth. So he was always reading about UFOs and close encounters. They had a real obsession.
I think they came and collected him.
Hmm? Oh yes, but everybody's in agreement that when it, that once he disappeared, that there was no real trace of him to be found anywhere.
Right.
And so this article that's posted on your website will, you know, keep your readers informed about this interesting case.
Very good. All right, hold on a minute. We have to do our little business here at the top of the hour. We'll come right back with Dr. Ray after this.